welcome to episode 205 of the Book Cougars, Two Middle-Aged Women on the Hunt for a Good Read. I'm Emily.
And I'm Chris. And we're going to start off talking about two giveaways that we have. Our April Patreon giveaway is...
Yeah, it's Bless Your Heart by Lindy Ryan. This one looks like so much fun.
Yes, it has a great cover. You'll see it on our social media. We have done a little video with it. I think we featured it on last week's Friday Reads video. It's a novel set in 1990 in the South with two sisters who run a funeral home, and the town gossip ends up in their funeral home. But
oopsie, she's not dead.
She is not dead. So this book involves vampires, and it sounds like a hoot. It sounds like a combination of horror, mystery, humor. Like fans of Grady Hendrix, the Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires. If you enjoyed that novel, sounds like you might enjoy this one. I haven't read it yet, but I will be soon.
And if you are a Patreon, by April 14th, you'll be automatically entered to win. And you can look for information in the show notes to find out how to become a Patreon. If you already are, good luck.
And thank you. Then the second giveaway we have was a quick turnaround from our newsletter that went out on the last day of March. It had a typo in it saying that this giveaway winner would be drawn on March 3rd. We actually meant April 3rd, which is today. So drum roll, we're picking a winner.
And this is for the novel The Awakening, The Dragonheart Legacy, Book 1 by Nora Roberts. And the winner is Callaway. Congratulations.
Congrats. And this is our second quarter read-along pick, which is one reason we wanted to have a quick turnaround with the giveaway opportunity, because we know some listeners jump on those read-along books right away and read them quite soon.
Yeah, we're really excited about this one. We've never read Nora Roberts. It was hard to choose what to read by her because she's incredibly prolific. We also wanted to try something in the fantasy romance genre, so that's why we chose it.
I'm going to be reading it sooner rather than later. I try to always gauge, like, you know, how soon, how close to the discussion do I read it, because I want it to be fresh in my mind. I think I'm going to start this one earlier than I normally do a read-along book, only because I am a little apprehensive. Yeah, the romance fantasy thing.
You think it might take you a little longer to read?
It might. Mm-hmm. It might. Because fantasy, I mean, I have read some fantasy. Like, I read the first book in The Lord of the Rings and never went further.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, I tried The Hobbit and didn't really go all that far. Although The Hobbit is one I do want to try.
That's one of my favorite books of all time.
Yeah, I know.
Although I don't know if I'd feel that way if I read it again. I read it in sixth grade, so... Well, in read-along news, also, we have a follow-up regarding our first quarter read-along of Indigo by Beverly Jenkins. I raised the question when we were talking about it, because the main character's name is Hester. Was that a nod to the Scarlet Letter, Hester? And we heard directly from the author, Beverly Jenkins, via social media, that indeed, no.
No.
And no one had ever asked her that in the 30 some odd years since this book was published.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. Yeah. So, yeah, she was funny because she was an English major, and she said she had nothing to do with the Scarlet Letter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So interesting. So thank you, Beverly, for clarifying that. On with the show. Chris, what are you currently reading?
Well, I'm sad to say I will be starting with a DNF, my first DNF of the year, maybe. Not 100% on that. The Maiden by Kate Foster. I am on page 160. I know that's a long way. It's like halfway into the book. It is about a woman in 1697 Scotland. It's based on a true story. She was condemned to be executed for murdering her lover, who was her uncle by marriage. So I'm at the halfway point, and at this point, I'm just like, kill him already. Like, somebody kill him. Let's move along. So it's just not what I'm in the mood for right now. I'm going to keep it on my shelf and probably pick it up again. It's one of the books on the long list for the Woman's Prize. So I'm thinking it's a mood thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I too have a book that I am exactly on page 160. What's the irony
no
in that?
Way.
It's called Interesting Facts About Space by Emily Austin. This is a novel that I was really excited to get from Book of the Month Club. And I've been holding it because I thought, oh, this is going to be a quick, pleasant read. I might even sit down and read it in one day. And it's just not catching my attention, even though I've given it 160 pages. Her writing is kind of quirky. And I also wonder, it's making me feel a little bit like a prude because this woman has a lot of casual sex with people that she doesn't know. And it makes me uncomfortable. I feel like her mother as I'm reading it, like, you're making bad decisions. And I don't want to read and be judgy about anyone, even if they're fictional. So I've decided also to put this one away and maybe I'll come back to it. Again, that's called Interesting Facts About Space by Emily Austin. Have any of you read it? I know a lot of people had mixed feelings about her debut, which was called Everyone in This Room Will Someday Be Dead.
Which I enjoyed.
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
I did like it. And I think that is also probably a mood thing, I think. I think I was in the mood for something quirky and different.
Yeah, her writing is quirky.
Yeah. So mood reading is such a thing.
Yep.
And I think the older you get too, the less, I don't know, it's not less patience, but the more you know, there are so many other books that you really want to get to. And that if a book was meant to be read, it will call to you again in the future. Like War and Peace. I thought I was done with that bad boy. And it's creeping back into my mind again. I'm like, I thought I put that to rest. But anyway, well, you know, books are mysterious that way.
Yes, indeed.
So on to what I am still currently reading. I am currently reading Moby Dick by Herman Melville. I am really enjoying it. You know, I haven't had a ton of time to read lately. I do have more in the coming weeks, which I'm really excited about. I just finished the cetology chapter, which is one of the hard chapters for a lot of people because they're like, what the hell? Like, what is this about? Because he's organizing whales into different groupings. And it seems a little bit like this is not really part of the plot. I don't really understand why this is in here. I thought it was interesting the first time I read it because he's talking about the sperm whale and then all the way down to porpoises. And he makes up authorities, which I really enjoy in books and things like that. But what struck me this time with this chapter in particular, it's chapter 32 in the book, is that he organizes them according to book size. The folio whale, the octavo whale, the duodecimo whale. So those are all book sizes. And I thought that was a really interesting way to present them. Because, you know, naturalists have been categorizing living things forever, right? Back to the Greeks. And I wonder about equating them to book sizes and just how important the book was becoming at that time in, you know, the 1840s or so when he was writing this. And just having taken book history and learning about how books are made and different sizes are made because of the process of making different types of books. It was kind of a fun thing. So more to come on Moby Dick. I'm reading it with some friends and we're doing a kind of a slow read of it. I think we're scheduled to be finished early May sometime.
Very cool.
So far, just as good the second time around.
Good for you. Well, in honor of National Poetry Month, I'm immersed in a new collection called You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World, edited and introduced by our 24th Poet Laureate of the United States, Ada Limón. And this is, as it suggests in the title, nature poetry. And I'm just going to read from the flap because I thought this was really interesting. For many years, nature poetry has evoked images of romantic poets standing on mountaintops. But our poetic landscape has changed dramatically, and so has our planet. Edited and introduced by Ada Limón, this book challenges what we think we know about nature poetry, illuminating the myriad ways our landscapes, both literal and literary, are changing. So they're kind of trying to bring in, you know, the notion of climate change into what's happening in our world. And this is an anthology with 50 different poets. And I thought I would just read you one by Michael Kleber Diggs. And what I like about this anthology is on the left-hand side of the page is a little blurb about the author, the poet, and then on the right is their poem. And so Michael is the author of the debut collection Worldly Things, which won the Max Ritvo Poetry Prize, the Hefner Heights, Kansas Book Award, and the Balcones Prize for Poetry, and was a finalist for the Minnesota Book Award. He's also currently working on a memoir that is about his complicated history with lap swimming called My Weight in Water, which is so intriguing to me. And he lives near a large regional park in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he walks almost every day with his golden doodles, Ziggy and Jasper. So part of why I chose this poem, Chris, is because I know you are definitely a dog lover, and we have lots of listeners who are. And this is called Canine Superpowers. We stroll the grounds and stop at every tree, at every chicken bone, each new coneflower. Their noses lead to everything we see. I'd be asleep if it were up to me. Still slick with dew, this city park seems ours as we stroll the grounds and stop at every tree. Perils persist, real possibilities. I scan the grass for things they can't devour. Their noses notice things that might harm me. Sometimes we'll spot a fox, surprise a bee, find trash, broken glass, have a sad encounter on our daily rounds to check on every tree. 3 times we've come upon wild coyotes, sensed before seen through canine superpowers. All of them have smelled what I'm soon to see. They stare, we stare, there's no anxiety. Milliseconds transform into hours. We stroll the grounds and stop at every tree. Their noses lead to everything I see.
Lovely.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a poetry collection, I always think these anthologies are a really great way to go because it gives you exposure to, in this case, 50 different poets and their style. Happy Poetry Month, everybody. Again, this collection is called You Are Here, edited by Ada Limon.
Lovely. The whole thing about coyotes, we have a lot of coyotes in our area, and I often see people posting on one of the town websites like, this coyote followed me and my dog for a block, and people are worried about coyotes attacking them. Well, on another site I saw recently that it's a coyote behavior called escorting, that what they're doing is they're escorting you away from where their nest is.
Oh, interesting.
So they're protecting their young. And so that behavior happens more in the spring when they're having pups.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. So, well, I too have a bit of poetry for Poetry Month. I've taken all of my poetry books off the shelf and put them in one location just so I have them all together. And the first one I started with is one that I've read before. It's by Sandra Yanon, and it's called Boats for Women. And one of the reasons I picked this up is that Sandy has her second poetry collection coming out soon, and that is called The Glass Studio. And I ordered a copy. It should be here any day. I was hoping to have it for a recording day. But what's neat about this, and I didn't really make the connection when this book first came out, and thank you to the publisher for having sent a review copy, and this is back in 2019. The publisher is Salmon Poetry, and they are in Ireland. And I love their name, Salmon Poetry, and there's their logo I'm showing to Emily. It's a circular logo that the bottom half is water, and then there's a big salmon rising from it. And this is a quote that they have right underneath their logo. Like the sea-run steelhead salmon that thrashes upstream to its spawning ground, then instead of dying, returns to the sea, Salmon Poetry Press brings precious cargo to both Ireland and America in the poetry it publishes, then carries that select work to its readership against incalculable odds.
Oh, I love that.
Isn't that great? So both of Sandy's collections are published through Salmon Poetry. I should say Sandy's a friend of mine from back in my University of Nebraska days. She was working on her PhD when I was there working on my master's. So it's nice to be reconnected with her by the powers of Facebook. She's really into the Titanic. She became fascinated as a kid with the Titanic and all things nautical because she grew up in Old Saybrook on the shoreline, just down the road from where we are in Guilford. So I wanted to read one of her poems. I really like it because it incorporates the Titanic and coming out in relationships in a really interesting way. And it's, you know, an understandable poem.
Yeah, I like them to be accessible. I don't want to take time on each line to try to figure out what's happening.
Yeah. And this is a poem. It's three line stanzas. The title is Providence, April 14th, 1998. When I call my parents to wish their marriage continued success, hear the Connecticut shore breaking in the background, I am thinking also of the ship, hoping that maybe on this April 14th, the Titanic doesn't hit the iceberg, that Captain Smith for once heeds the warnings of ice and doesn't give in to speed, that the lookouts have binoculars, that the Californian doesn't put its radio to sleep 10 minutes before the first distress call. But my mother isn't thinking about her anniversary or the iceberg when I call. She is thinking about Providence when she says she has something she wants to ask me. Thinking about Providence before and after I hung up, the Providence of last summer's love now ringing in my ears, and all that week before spent convincing my mother that she was just a friend. But I was nervous at dinner, couldn't eat. On the drive to Providence, I grew tired and had to stop at the scenic overlook in Mystic, where, in the dark, I could just make out the shadows of the historic ships pressed against the night. In Providence, her plane was the last to land and late, pulling into its gate like the Carpathia arrived in New York, alone and anticipated. I sat in the airport with my head in my hands, afraid of whomever might not deplane. But when I look up, she stood before me with her luggage in hand, and in the middle of the terminal, we held each other as survivors of what we did not yet know.
Mm.
I just love that poem.
Yeah,
yeah, I think that I really appreciate poets who can incorporate history and historical events and then nautical things into a poem about relationships.
Yeah, that was quite brilliant, actually. And then the play on the word Providence, even though that really is a place where an airport is.
Right, you know? Yeah.
So interesting. Wow, yeah. Thanks for sharing.
Absolutely. So again, that was from Sandra Yanone's collection, Boats for Women.
I'm reading a novel called Piglet by Lottie Hazel. And I heard about this book via the New York Times book review written by Jennifer Weiner, who's an author who I really enjoy reading, and I just really respect her opinions. So Piglet is about a young woman who's 98 days away from getting married. And I only know that because that's how the novel starts, with something that says 98 days. And she's engaged to be married to a man named Kit. They're living together. She works at a London publishing company that has a focus on cookbooks. And her nickname, Piglet, comes from her family of origin. Growing up, she was like, as her dad describes her, a Hoover vacuum that would eat anything. So we know how those nicknames can stick with us and family lore can stick with us. So that's part of what the novel's about, but it's also about just appetite in general and cooking. There is so much food in here and so much dialogue. So much of the book is written in dialogue and descriptions of food. It's so interesting. And there are a cast of other characters, including her best friend from growing up, Margot, who's pregnant, and her sister, Franny, who's living at home with her parents. And there's also a tension between her parents and Franny, who are living back in the family homestead where they didn't have much wealth. And Piglet is marrying into a family with some wealth. The book kind of counts down closer to her marriage, and a couple weeks before the marriage, her fiancé admits something to her that he's done, but we don't know what it is.
And it's not making her happy.
No. And that's all I'm going to say about it. It's a fast read. I picked it up from the library last night, and I'm already 150 pages in. The only other thing I want to say about it is there's been lots of complaints online that I've read that the UK copy, the cover is like this beautiful stack of donuts. And in the US, our cover is more like a hamburger, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, like a double-decker kind of burger.
Yeah, so I'm really enjoying it. I don't think this book will be for everyone because of the style in which it's written, but it's really working for me. And I should say it's a debut as well. Piglet, Lottie Hazel.
Well, I'm also reading another book for National Poetry Month, and this one is called The Highest Apple, Sappho and the Lesbian Poetic Tradition. It's by Judy Gran. It's an updated new edition of a book that was first put out in 1985, I think it was. This new edition is by Sinister Wisdom. And I am just, well, not that far in, 30 pages. And one of the striking things was at the beginning, Grant has an introduction. And she talks about the word marginal. And she's talking about how, you know, lesbians, the lesbian community is considered marginal, but how people like Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman considered marginal, but like no one is marginal within their own community, within their own life, right? But then there's this line that I really love. Marginal is a word that implies there is one world and it is flat. I love that. I love that so much. Typical poet, right? Who takes one word and can really blow your mind by giving you a different perspective on it.
Yeah, that's their strength.
Yes, isn't it? So more to come on this. I got this, I think, late last year. I think it came out late last year. I have a subscription to Sinister Wisdom, and I've been saving this. Yeah, it just came out November 2023. I was saving it to read for National Poetry Month. So again, that's The Highest Apple by Judy Gran.
I'm listening to a book called Break the Cycle, A Guide to Healing Intergenerational Trauma, and this is by Dr. Marielle Bouquet. It's an audiobook read by her. She's the narrator, and she has a beautiful voice. The other night, I got a little tweaked by something in my family of origin. It was via a telephone conversation, and I hung up the phone, and as we are wont to do, I decided to go to Instagram to drown my sorrows in mindless scrolling. And what pops up, I mean, literally popped up, was Liz Gilbert live, Instagram live, talking to Dr. Marielle Bouquet. And she said five words that totally changed my life, as happens sometimes. The universe sends us exactly what we need. Liz Gilbert has this book club that she calls the Onward Book Club, where she interviews Black female authors. I think it's once a month. It might not be once a month. And so Break the Cycle, A Guide to Healing Intergenerational Trauma was her book for March. And I just happened to catch the tail end of the live conversation. They are on Liz Gilbert's Instagram feed, you know, once the conversation's over. So you can certainly check there. Marielle Bouquet has a PhD in trauma psychology. And the book, she talks about the reasons behind intergenerational trauma, and then also the power of breaking the cycle, which is why the book is titled Break the Cycle. And she offers really practical exercises on how to break the cycle, and then also gives you some understanding about what intergenerational trauma is. There's so much new learning happening around that, including epigenetics. And the next chapter I have is all about epigenetics, so I'm super excited. Nice. And she also uses a blend of ancient practices too, like sound baths and drinking special teas. She's very much into tea. So I highly recommend it. Again, it's called Break the Cycle, A Guide to Healing Intergenerational Trauma by Dr. Marielle Bouquet. I love it when a book finds you.
Absolutely. Right time, space, continuum.
Yep.
Well, my self-improvement book of the quarter is Building a Second Brain, A Proven Method to Organize Your Digital Life and Unlock Your Creative Potential. And this is by Tiago Forte. On the top, it says, remember everything, achieve anything. I'm like, well, okay. That's some big promise
right
there. If
you help
me. Right? Yeah. I have talked about him before on the podcast. This is his first book, I believe, and his second book was about his PARA method, mm-hmm. P-A-R-A, that I've incorporated into my digital organization of my files, which has been really helpful. And I've actually stuck to it now for not exactly a year, but at least 6 months, I think. So this book is one that I've had, and I thought I will start it now. And I am enjoying it. I'm reading it slowly. I have to say, hello, my name is Chris, and I am an information hoarder. So
that's, it's so hard now not to be. Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. I know, right? And it's so easy to save things. You know, if you use any type of read later app or, you know, download to your hard drive, whatever the case may be. So that already has been helpful. I mean, even just having read his book on that para method was helpful in terms of just archiving something. As he says in that book, you really don't ever have to delete anything anymore. You can just archive it because we have so much space on our hard drives as opposed to 10, 15 years ago, right? When you had to scramble to make room for your computer to friggin' work.
Yeah.
But I have started deleting things because it feels good to say like, yeah, I'm not interested in that anymore. And if I am, I know it's something that's easily findable because it's a New York Times article or something. So I'll just delete.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because even though they're digital closets, so to speak, they still have some weight to them, I think. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
They cause anxiety.
Yeah.
It's one of his points is that it does cause anxiety when you have all of this and you feel like you're chronically behind and you chronically have more to read. And one of his goals in working with the students that he has in the classes he teaches is to use these digital tools in a way that frees you to actually live your life and to have time to think and to just ramble around and enjoy life as opposed to constantly feeling like, what do I have to do? Oh, I haven't done that. Mm-hmm. So I could use that help.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he has a YouTube channel, which is, I think, where I originally came across him. So that's Building a Second Brain by Tiago Forte.
I'm reading Chasing Beauty, The Life of Isabella Stewart Gardner by Natalie Dykstra. When we were going to Simmons a few times when Chris was in school and we went to work at the library there and Chris was doing some archival research, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum is literally right next door. And I remember we had time with my niece, Sarah, who lives in Boston, is doing her residency there. And she said, oh, if you guys get a chance, you should really go to that museum. It's beautiful. We haven't had a chance. But then we saw that this book came out that's all about the life of Isabel Stewart Gardner, who is the woman who created this museum that resides in Boston. I've just barely started it. I'm a few chapters in. I had to laugh, Chris, because the first chapter is about her childhood in New York. It talks about how she became interested in looking up her family tree and was doing work on it. And she said she was fascinated by a hoped-for link between her branch of the Stuart family and Mary, Queen of Scots.
Nice.
So she collected images of the doomed queen as well as relics, hoping that there was a relationship. I don't think she ever determined that there was. But what the museum is really known for is that she put together interesting mixes of things. So it's not just straight paintings. There's installations and objects, and it's really an ode to the beauty of art in all its forms, which is, I think, why the title, Chasing Beauty. So I'm really enjoying it. I don't know much about her. I'm anxious to learn more and then to go to this museum. The one thing so far that I've learned in this opening chapter about her childhood is she had loss pretty early in her life. She went by the name Belle as a child. Her sister died when Belle was 12, and then both her brothers died in their early 20s. And her parents mourned in a different way. They mourned by having art created memorializing her siblings. In this case, it was pieces of stained glass in a church. So Dykstra hypothesizes that that was kind of Belle's early introduction into art as a form of remembering people and places.
Yeah. Yeah. Very.
Yeah.
And memorializing them, that it's a beautiful. Yeah. That's really wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think they maybe didn't talk about it. I mean, sometimes you can do that. So you also like imbue objects with your emotions and your feelings, which would make sense because she created this museum filled with objects that was endowed and she requested that nothing ever be changed.
Hmm. Interesting. So you're saying that by having these works of art that may represent a family member, that takes the place of actually working on your feelings about the person or the family talking about the person because the art takes the place of that emotional need?
I think it's like when you die or when someone you love dies, is it important to have a tombstone or a tree or something where people can physically go and remember you? And I think that's what her family did. They created monuments to her, to people who passed away, And then seemingly they also didn't necessarily talk too much about the deaths. I'm very, very early into the book, but that was my takeaway when they were talking about creating these pieces of stained glass. I'll report back if I learn differently. And maybe it was just that Belle did it. Maybe it wasn't her parents, but you know, she was 12 years old when her sister died, and they created this monument in the church of this piece of stained glass in honor of her. And so I think she picked up that trait of imbuing beautiful pieces of art with feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if it replaced the conversation or not. That was the take I had on my first pass of reading it.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So, Chasing Beauty, any of you art lovers out there, I'm really intrigued. And there's some really fun color pictures throughout, and black and white as well.
Cool. Well, I sense a biblio adventure coming on to Boston.
Yep.
This episode is sponsored by
Clitapalooza, Her Flower Blooms Power by Billy Best, is a fun feminist satire about a lusty midlife math professor's reckless adventure with a hunky chatbot who isn't as innocent as he appears to be. When her vibrator starts sharing data with her toothbrush, she realizes she's in trouble and turns to her students for help. Girl Talk drives the plot with strong friendships and empowering intimacy. Clitapalooza, Her Flower Blooms Power is available now. Check the show notes for links to the book and Billy Best's blog. Chris, what did you just read?
So I finished the audiobook I was listening to, Wake Up With Purpose, What I've Learned in My First 100 Years by Sister Jean. And that's Sister Jean Dolores Schmidt. She was writing this with Seth Davis, and it was narrated by Devon O'Day. I chose this one because I came across the book. I mean, you know, Sister Jean was very popular in the national media some years ago for Loyola University making it into the Final Four for basketball. So Sister Jean was everywhere. I saw the book in a bookstore and was going to get it at one point, but I didn't. And when I was looking for short audiobooks, this is one that popped up. 6 hours and 11 minutes. Sister Jean reads like the prologue, so it's really great to hear her voice. She's now 104 years old, which is amazing, and she's still the chaplain of Loyola's men's basketball team, and she works with students every day. She wheels around campus. She's in a wheelchair since she broke her hip and trying to work to get out of it. So just an amazing life that she's lived. She was born in 1919. If you can imagine that, and just so many of the things she saw. She became a nun at a young age, like she knew like in third grade that that's what she wanted to do. It starts out as a really good autobiography of her earlier days and some of her first assignments as a nun. Like she was in California where she was a teacher. This is when Imperial Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. And the aftermath of that, you know, living in California, some things that I never heard before, like that the children had to wear dog tags and they were told to walk to and from school the same way every day. So that if there were an attack, they would know where to look for them. You know, you typically don't hear a lot of things about what daily life was like for people in California at that time or the West Coast. I know we've read books about the internment of Japanese American citizens, which was a crime against humanity. But in terms of being a school child, a white school child, what they may have been feeling. But she ends up in Chicago working at Mundelein University. One of my aunts went there, and it's right next door to Loyola. So when Mundelein was facing financial hardship, Loyola, they merged the two schools. So then she became a Loyola employee, working with the students and doing other things. And it gets into basketball towards the mid to end. I'm not a basketball fan. So she talks about the program a lot from like the coaches and coach turnover, different basketball players. And I suppose for a basketball fan, that would be really fun to listen to. I think, as I said in my review, I may have DNF'd it had I been reading a physical copy. But, you know, I'm in my car going to and from work, so whatever, right? Just listening. And she does have some good personal things that she mentions, because after she retires, she's working in a doctor's office. Like, this woman is constantly working. Obviously a people person. I think if you are into nuns and curious about what a nun's life could be like, if you're a basketball fan, if you just like to listen to an interesting memoir by a really interesting person.
Who's lived a long life.
Like, I want to read her biography because I think it'd be really fascinating because she did a lot of different positions at Mundelein and then at Loyola. So it would be fascinating to learn more about that. So again, that was Wake Up with Purpose by Sister Jean.
And we'll put a link in the show notes to Chris's review on her blog. It was a really good review.
Thank you.
I finished Intimacies by Katie Kitamura. This was a novel I'd heard a lot about. And then when I was at that walk-in little free library in Bald Head, North Carolina, I found a copy of it. And it's about an interpreter who goes to The Hague. She's kind of fleeing New York City, looking for a new lease on life. And she starts work as an interpreter at The Hague in the International Court. I have to say, all my life I've heard the term The Hague, but I didn't really know what it is and what they do there. And it is a city. I looked it up, you know, on the western part of the Netherlands, and the UN International Court of Justice resides there. And so the International Court is very important to the city. The main character, the interpreter, she's seeking home and belonging. And at the same time, she gets involved with a married man, and she's also going to work to interpret. And she is asked to interpret a somewhat intense case involving a president of an African country who's accused of these heinous crimes. And so it really is a novel that helps you understand. You have this image of someone just interpreting words, but she also has to digest these horrible things that she's hearing and interpreting. And she's interpreting for the benefit of this man who's done terrible things. And they start to establish, I wouldn't go as far as to say a relationship, but they become acquaintances because day after day, she's interpreting for him. There's also violence that occurs closer to home with some of the people that she's getting to know. I have to say, I didn't love it. It was one of those novels, like, it was compelling and I wanted to see what happened, but I didn't feel compelled at the same time to pick it up and read it. And one of our listeners, Linda, when she saw, because I talked about this on our BookTube Friday reads, she was like, oh, I'm going to not say how I felt about that book, but I kind of knew what that meant. And then after I finished it, I was like, oh, it was so-so. And she said, yeah, that's how I felt about it. But she said, then when I read it, you know, when I talked to people about it who had read it, I felt differently about it. So I went out and read reviews and I felt completely different after I read the reviews. You know how that happens?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely a novel that I was very glad to have read and very glad to have finished.
Yeah.
So again, that's called Intimacies by Katie Kitamura.
I mean, isn't that interesting? Like, it's a book that you're reading and you're like, but you keep reading it. Yeah. You know, what is it that kind of tugs at you to keep going with some books and others you're like, nope, time to...
Well, her writing's very accessible. It wasn't like it was hard work to read it. I think if I really had to be honest, part of it is it just makes you feel a little uncomfortable. You know, the subject matter is slightly uncomfortable. I think that's it. Mm-hmm. But I was compelled because I wanted to know what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, good. Well, I read an interesting first issue of a new comic for adults, DPROG, number one. And this is created by Tina Horn, Lisa Sterl, Gabe Contreras, and Danny from Dead Sky. So it's a comic book. I didn't bring it with me, not that the listeners could see what I wanted to show Emily. It's kind of dark, so it has that noir feeling. And let me just read you a little bit of a description of this. So DPROG is a new detective thriller. Meet Tate Debs. That's the main character's name. A hard-boiled, hard-drinking, leather-loving dyke detective with an office in the back of Los Angeles's last video store. Tate specializes in rescuing and deprogramming people from abusive groups with extreme beliefs, like the one Tate herself escaped, that believed in interdimensional travel and taboo ritual sex. When a femme named Vera, who may just be a fatale, hires Tate to infiltrate a group of mystical hippies out in the desert, She must decide if Vera's charms are worth being re-traumatized. Soon, Tate must face her past out of devotion to the femme she may be falling for and a single-minded drive to avenge her family. It sounds like the whole series is going to be really intense. So it is hardcore. Let's just put it that way. It may not be for everyone, but if you are interested at all, I would recommend it. Comics are hard. You and I have talked about them before with graphic novels. You know, we're such word people, so we're always drawn to the words. And it's kind of like, slow down, look at the images. What are the images conveying? Let the images create some of the emotion, right, that mm-hmm. you're supposed to feel. And so I think sometimes when I've read comics or graphic novels, I forget that. And I think like, oh, okay. But then if you go back and you combine those images, it has a very different emotional impact.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So again, that's Deep Prague.
I finished a book that I picked up and didn't expect to read cover to cover in one day, but I did. Huh. It's called A Baker's Year, 12 Months of Baking and Living the Simple Life at the Smoke Signals Bakery by Tara Jensen. I am a huge follower of Tara Jensen on Instagram. I find her very fascinating. She has been cooking with sourdough before everyone started cooking with sourdough over the pandemic, but is a great resource if you are interested in sourdough. This came out in 2018, and at the time, she was writing about her year living at the Smoke Signals Bakery, which was in a very remote part of Virginia. At the beginning of the story, she's there with a man who she has a terrible breakup with. And so she ends up really living there alone and baking, and it's all wood-fired baking. So a lot of it is about getting through the winter and staying warm, keeping the oven hot. At the beginning of each month, there's a little hand-done sketch. I'm holding it up for Chris. So this is actually what the Smoke Signals Bakery looks like. And then she has a little note from her journal that she hand writes. So this one in January was, I raise my hand as your witness, posted January 16th. All of the photos in it were done by her as well. They're beautiful photographs. And there are really great recipes that I see myself making in the future, including waffles. I'm going to find this picture. Here it is. She gets this waffle maker, an old cast iron that she uses over a flame.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed it. Super simple recipes, a lot of whole grains. She's all about whole grains. And I have her second cookbook, Flower Power, at home waiting to be read and looked through. And in that book, I think fast forward maybe 4 years, she's married and is the mother of a daughter who she names Violet Rye. I love that her middle name is Rye.
Yeah.
So she's no longer living a life of solitude. And now fast forward to 2024, or maybe it happened in 2023, she had twins. So she's now the mother of three. And I know she's working on a cookbook about wood-fired pizza. So that's cool.
Very cool. So is she still out there at Smoke Signals?
No, okay. She's actually moved, I think, a couple times since she lived there. And she purchased this big wood-fired oven, pizza-type style oven that she would pull on the back of a truck. And she does a lot of workshops, so she would take that to different places. I'll put a link in the show notes to her website if you're interested in learning more about her.
Cool.
But I think recently she sold that. I mean, I'm a slight stalker, but I don't stalk her enough to know what's actually happening with her physical residence. But I know that she's very busy raising children and baking. Again, her name is Tara Jensen, and this is called A Baker's Year.
Well, the last thing that I read is a book that I knew I'd only read one chapter of. I think it was last episode I talked about The Woman's Long List having been released and that I downloaded the previews that you can download of digital books when they're available, usually. So the first one that I have read is River East, River West by Aubrey Lescure. This one has a great start, and I'm totally tempted to read more. And I think after I read the chapter of each one, I think I'll probably end up going back and reading some of them, possibly. You know how that goes. But this one is about a 14-year-old girl who is half American, half Chinese. She's been living in China with her mom, who's an American, and maybe was a former movie actor. I'm not really sure. But her mom is very typical white, I think blonde-haired looking woman. And her daughter, who is half Chinese, half her, looks much more Chinese. And she is at the wedding of her mother, who is marrying this man that she doesn't really like, who's Chinese, who seems to be a little bit stuffed into his suit, maybe not the most handsome man, also their landlord. And her daughter's like, there's been so many men, why this one? Like, why is she getting married now? And the opening scene is at the wedding reception, and the daughter's standing there, and just off is a group of women, a lot of wealth in this room, she says, with purses casually strung over the chairs, but not casually enough to obscure the logos, Gucci's and whatnot. And these women are speaking in, I think, Mandarin, and assuming that this girl, who's half American, half Chinese, doesn't speak the language. And then they switch to a Shanghai dialect, and this takes place in Shanghai. And, you know, the daughter understands everything that they're saying. And so towards the end of that first chapter, you know, she turns and says something to them, and they're like, oh my, you know, kind of thing. I was instantly curious about, okay, who is this mother? Why has she been living in China, going from man to man? What's that about? And then this daughter, because the mom always calls the daughter partner. And now that she's married, the daughter's like, I guess you can't call me that anymore. So really, really great first chapter.
Sounds like Entanglements, you know?
Yes. Yeah. So that's River East, River West by Aubrey Lescure.
I admire your ability to not just go get the rest of the book and dig in.
I know, right? We'll see how that goes. But that's something I did when I decided I was going to DNF another book. I thought, oh, let me read a first chapter. Mm-hmm. Because I think I fell into that thing where I was reading too many books mm-hmm. at the same time, and I just got overwhelmed and wasn't really reading anything all that satisfactorily. So
yeah,
that helped.
Well, I finished a debut called When Cicadas Cry by Carolyn Cleveland. This book pubs on May 7th, 2024. Carolyn Cleveland is a lawyer, so longtime listeners know I'm drawn to these books written by lawyers. And this is about Zach Stander, who's a lawyer in Charleston, and he has a bit of a checkered past, which we don't totally understand, but he's trying to get back on his feet. And his partner is Addie, who's a local detective. They end up as the team working on a trial because a young man's uncle calls them. The young man's name is Sam Jenkins. He's a black man who was the one that called 911 when he found a white woman in a church who had been bludgeoned to death using a cross in the church. That happened right away. These are not typical Emily books at all, but I was like, there's going to be courtroom drama. I'm in it for that. Well, there wasn't much courtroom drama, but what did draw me in right away was that there are some chapters told from the perspective of the person who does the killing. And as the chapters come, like, you start to realize that this person also is proximate to Zach and to Addie, who are involved in defending Sam, who's been accused of the murder. So that got my attention. I enjoyed it, and I really wanted to see what happened. There was a point, and I don't mean this in a knock at all to the author, but there was a point where I turned to the gentleman caller because we were reading beside each other on the couch, and I said, it's interesting every once in a while to read a debut that makes you realize how well written some books are. And again, I don't mean that as a knock to her, but it was just like, oh yeah, she's new at this. Like, the dialogue wasn't as smooth and the story sometimes wasn't as smooth. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do know what you mean. And you're also a critical reader, you know, mm-hmm. and can see those things when there's cracks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I enjoyed it. I'm glad I read it. I would recommend it. It's very Southern, so if you're interested in that, there were some fun characters. An old murder is also resurfaces and becomes part of the story. So I thought that the plot was very interesting and very different, particularly using this feature of having the murderer be telling the story from their point of view as well. There were just a few times when I was like, oh, right, debut novelist, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. I mean, is it a situation too where you just noticed some of those things, or did you also feel like you could have seen how things could have been portrayed differently?
No, I think it was really about writing.
Yeah.
Which makes you think about when a famous author like Anne Napolitano, who I love, who she most recently wrote Hello Beautiful, they just reissued, I think, her very first novel. And it makes you wonder if I wanted to take the time, which I don't know that I will, to go read her first novel, how it would compare.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many writers that have disown their first novels,
right.
Like Willa Cather and Nathaniel Hawthorne, you know, and they're good novels. I've read both of their first ones and they're fine, but they're just not marked by their style,
right,
that they've matured into.
Yeah. So again, if you're looking for a page turner, not much courtroom drama. There's more out of the courtroom drama than in the courtroom. When Cicadas Cry, Carolyn Cleveland, publishing on May 7th.
My brain doesn't know what to do with that because I hear Prince singing When the Doves Cry, and then I hear the Owens novel, you know.
Oh, when Crawdads Sing.
When Crawdads Sing, yeah.
Well, the When Cicadas Cry, the very beginning, she talks about how cicadas come out every 17 years. And in, I think it was 2018, I don't have the novel with me because I dropped it in the bathtub. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are cicadas that come out every year. But then there are those huge crops that only come out every 17 years.
Right. And at the beginning of the novel, I think it was in 2018 that they came out down south. And the same year that, unfortunately, there was a killing in a church. Mm. And it stirred up historical killings in churches that we've had in the United States in the past. So that's what the point of the title is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really compelling title.
Yeah.
Biblio adventures.
I had some good Biblio adventures. The first one was I went to RJ Julia Booksellers here in Madison, Connecticut, just the town over from where we live, and I saw Rachel Slade talking about her new book, Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA. And if you recognize her name, she also was the author of the book called Into the Raging Sea, which was about the sinking of the El Faro, which was a container ship that sunk and all 33 people on board were killed. And it was somewhat ironic to be listening to her last week when the container ship in Baltimore destroyed a bridge. And she had a few things to say about that, but that wasn't the point of what she was there to talk about. This book, Making It in America, is about Ben and Whitney Waxman, who live in Maine and are trying to manufacture clothing, particularly a hoodie, as I sit across from Chris as she's wearing a hoodie. And one of the things Rachel says is that the hoodie is kind of the perfect piece of apparel. You know, it has a hood in case you need it. It has a zipper, so if you get warm, you can unzip it. It has pockets for your hands. And they are on a quest to make it utilizing all American-made goods, from the fabrics to the zipper, the eyelets, you know, everything. She follows the story about what happens to them during the pandemic, because it's hard enough to be a manufacturer in the United States these days, but then when you put the pandemic on top of it, really interesting. She's a very compelling speaker. I think if you could get a chance to see her on book tour, I would recommend it. And just one of the points she makes also is that the apparel industry is very, very fraught when it comes to environmental damage, which is obviously something with climate change that we're worried about. And she talked about how her grandfather back in the day owned a factory in Pennsylvania that manufactured clothing. And she still has some of those pieces of clothing of her grandmother's and can wear them today. They're beautiful. They're very old. But one of the points she made is that back in the day when you would buy apparel, you didn't buy as much as we buy now, but also the tag inside would tell you the factory name. Now we have a designer name and we have no idea generally where it's made. Usually it'll sell you somewhere on the label, but it's very small and sometimes can be hard to find, like on a seam or something like that. And I thought that was a really interesting point. So the point she was trying to make is, as consumers, it can be more difficult for us to try to use our money to make good choices for the environment. Mm-hmm. But the apparel industry is being taken to task because of its polluting nature. So I think we're going to see more consumer care about where we buy our apparel. I didn't buy a copy of the book, but I think I'm going to try to get it on audio. Again, it's called Making It in America by Rachel Slade. It was an interesting event. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, I haven't really been on any biblio adventures, classic biblio adventures. I've been working, but it's been a fun semester. This is my second semester on the job. And, you know, the first semester, the students are new, a lot of them, right? And so as a reference and instruction librarian, we sometimes teach classes. We have a classroom in the library introducing students to research and information literacy concepts, how to analyze sources and things like that. This semester, I'm getting more one-on-one research appointments, which are a lot of fun because students are writing research papers this second semester. It's enjoyable to see the topics that they're choosing to. But one student came up to me one day, and this is unusual, but you know, she was waiting for her tutor to come. And she's like, can you tell me what do you think this paragraph means? And so I'm reading the paragraph, and it's like, Nathaniel Hawthorne's story, The Birthmark. I'm like, oh, okay. So she's like, I think the paragraph means this. And I said, okay. I said, well, let's look up some of these words, because he uses some archaic words. So we just had a really lovely conversation about what that paragraph meant and how it is applied to the rest of the story and the argument she was trying to make. So the former English teacher in me was so excited to talk about that, because as a reference librarian, you don't really talk about the meaning of a story, right? So that's been the extent of my biblio adventures of late.
That's awesome, though. Yeah. And did you tell her about your Scarlet Summer?
I did not. Because she had this, she's like, oh, she had that thought. She's like, thank you so much, and scurried off and picked up her laptop right. And started typing some more. So that was super rewarding.
Good for you. Yeah. That's awesome. They're lucky to have you over there. Listeners might remember that one of my goals for this year is every month to watch a book-to-film adaptation. So this month, we chose, I'm doing this with the gentleman caller, Adaptation, which is a 2002 film. It's very meta. It's about Charlie Kaufman, who's working furiously to create a screenplay for The Orchid Thief, which was written by Susan Orlean. Charlie Kaufman is played by Nicolas Cage. Susan Orlean is played by Meryl Streep. Chris Cooper plays the Orchid Thief, and I believe he won an Academy Award for his performance in that movie. Jim had never seen it. I have seen it before. It's very odd.
Yes.
But I really liked it. Have you seen it?
I have, yeah.
Did you like it?
I did. I haven't read The Orchid Thief. I think I watched it after I read her book, The Library, because I had a little Susan Orlean kick for a while. So yeah.
For some reason, I thought she had a cameo in the movie, but she doesn't. Mm. We've seen her. We got to go to a library event about that book that Chris is talking about, The Library. So I would recognize her if she was in it. But it was enjoyable. We both had a good time watching it and checked off our movie for the month.
Nice.
Do you have any upcoming jaunts?
I do. This is one coming up this Friday, so just a few days from now. The New York Antiquarian Book Fair is going on Friday to Sunday, and I plan on, well, Thursday to Sunday, really. Thursday is like a preview day, but I'm going to go on Friday. And really looking forward to it. Yeah. So I'll report back on some of the fun and exciting things I see.
Yes, I can't wait. I know you're on the hunt for a couple authors. I have one, thanks to one of our listeners who called in on the cat phone. We do have a cat phone. We should put the number in the show notes, shouldn't we? She called in to talk about the movie Shirley, which is a biopic about the novelist Shirley Jackson. So thank you for calling in. I think that will be our book-to-film adaptation this month. It's not a true, it's not based on a particular book, I don't think. I'll do a little more research, but we might be flexible.
Mm-hmm. I think from what I read about that one, I haven't seen it yet, but it's one I want to watch too eventually. I think it takes some of her nonfiction writing about raising children, maybe, that might have been an influence in the screenplay. It's been a while since I've read about that movie, so not sure, but maybe I'll try and watch it too, and we can have a conversation about it.
I would love that. Yeah, I think it does take place at her house in Bennington, which we've seen from the outside, so that could be really fun. Bennington, Vermont.
Yeah, that was a fun day. We had a Shirley Jackson day up in Vermont trying to see as many places related to her as we could.
Yeah, actually, we have a fun video about that. I'll put a link in the show notes to that if you want to see what it looks like.
And then we have a wonderful joint biblio adventure coming up along with our friend Kate, who is in the Bronx and is going to meet us in Nyack, New York, right there along the Hudson River. We're going to have a Carson McCullers Day.
Yeah, we're all reading one of her short stories.
Reflections in a Golden Eye.
Just to get in the mood.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Kate's going to be, I think she might have just started reading this as well. It's the new Carson McCullers biography by Mary V. Dearborn. We're going to be picking around in her biography, reading a short story, and looking at her house, which is the only home she purchased, as far as I know. And I think she lived there for the last 30 years of her life. And I'm so sorry, I don't remember the name of her last partner, romantic partner, who was also her psychotherapist for a while, who I think inherited or was in control of Carson's literary estate. She died not too long ago. She was over 100 years old, I believe. So a lot of these papers and things were released, and that home was donated to the Carson McCullers Center that's down in her hometown. Is it in Georgia? Oh. Yeah. The organization that controls that now owns this home in Nyack. And last I've heard, it's kind of being renovated a little bit for not sure what exactly. But we probably won't be able to get inside of it. But we're going to walk around and visit where she's laid to rest in the cemetery to pay our respects and just kind of hang out in Nyack.
Yeah, there's a great library there and a bookstore. So I'm really excited to spend the day with the three of us.
Yes. I'm really looking forward to it. It's been a while since we've gotten in the car and gone.
Yes, it has. It's time.
Yes.
I'm excited. So upcoming reads.
I have one that's been on the interwebs a lot. I've been seeing it, and it is called Bride by Allie Hazelwood. This is a vampire and werewolf story. I haven't read anything by her before, but I wanted to read her bio that's on the back of the book. Allie Hazelwood is the number one New York Times bestselling author of Love, Theoretically, and The Love Hypothesis, as well as a writer of peer-reviewed articles about brain science, in which no one makes out, and the ever after is not always happy. Originally from Italy, she lived in Germany and Japan before moving to the U.S. to pursue a PhD in neuroscience. When Allie is not at work, she can be found running, eating cake pops, or watching sci-fi movies with her three feline overlords and her slightly less feline husband. I love that thing, though, about the peer-reviewed articles.
Yes.
Yeah, not always happy endings there. So I'm going to dip into this really soon because it's a library copy that I have. It's a new book, so it's a short loan. When I was checking this book out and another one, I'm standing there at the circulation desk, and there's this, you know, stack of like three stacks of books. And I look, and the first one on there is that Frozen River.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, I was like, are these just been returned? Or she's like, yeah, they're waiting to get reshelved in the new displays there. It's like, oh, can I check it out? And she's like, yeah. I was like, okay. So I have that in my sweaty little hands too.
Right on. You've got plenty of pages to read ahead of you.
Yes.
And Bride by Allie Hazelwood was also put on our radar by listener Linda in Berkeley as a potential for a read-along, because it is a romance, I believe.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. That's why I reserved it, or put it on hold, I should say.
Checking things off her bingo card.
Yes, indeed.
Speaking of which, there is a link in the show notes to the romance bingo card if you would like to track your romance reading and biblio adventuring.
And we need to share a picture of ours. I know we said we'd do that. We haven't yet.
Oh, we'll do that.
I need to update mine.
Yes, me too. Well, I have one book on my upcoming reads as well. It's called The Twilight Garden by Sarah Nisha Adams. This has been mentioned on the podcast before as an upcoming read that we were excited about. And congratulations to Sarah, because the day this podcast drops, April 9th, is Pub Day here in the United States. And some of you might recognize her name. She's also the author of The Reading List, which was one of our favorite read-alongs, our year of reading books about books.
Beautiful cover.
Yes, I can't wait to dip into this one. In the Out Now category, these are books that have been mentioned on the podcast in the past, before Pub Day. They are now available. The Sicilian Inheritance by Joe Piazza, The Husbands by Holly Gramazio, Victory Parade by Leela Corman, A Killing on the Hill, a Thriller by Robert Dugoni, and How to End a Love Story by Yulene Kwong.
Yes, and Yulene is our author spotlight coming up next. We had a wonderful time talking with her about this debut novel. It's a rom-com. Emily really enjoyed it. I'm currently reading it, and I really like her writing style. It's straightforward and fresh, and I feel like the character just pops off this page.
The novel draws you in right away. Highly recommend. It's also a great one to mark off a square on your bingo card.
Yeah, and it's a contemporary romance. It's not historical. It's not fantasy for you all who are not drawn to that. So it's a kind of straightforward romantic romance.
Yeah, and Yulene works in writers' rooms helping to bring books to film or television series. And that is one of the threads in the novel. And it's so realistic and so well done because she obviously has experience
right.
with that.
Yeah. So you feel like, oh my gosh, so that's what that's like to be in a writer's room.
Right.
So enjoy our conversation with her. We certainly did. Again, that's How to End a Love Story by Yulene Kwong.
Happy reading.
We are thrilled to talk with screenwriter, director, and novelist Yulene Kwong. Yulene was born in Guangzhou, China, and grew up in Kansas, New Jersey, and Pittsburgh. She now resides in L.A., where she works as a filmmaker. Her credits include CW's I Ship It and Hulu's Dollface, and she has a highly entertaining YouTube channel, Yulene is Working. Warning, you might get pleasantly trapped binging her literary shorts. She's currently working on two projects involving the novels of fellow romance novelist Emily Henry. Yulene's first novel, How to End a Love Story, is an emotionally driven and humorous They Should Never Be Together romance novel, and we can't wait to talk with her about it. Welcome, Yulene.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yulene, we know you're a debut novelist, but we're going to put you on the spot anyway and ask you to give the elevator pitch about what this novel is about.
How to End a Love Story is a story of a screenwriter and a novelist who knew each other 13 years ago in high school. She was kind of the school newspaper overachiever type, and he was like homecoming king, football star, class president. And one night they were united by a great tragedy, which I don't think is a spoiler to share because it's in the first chapter, which is that her sister dies by suicide by walking into traffic, and he is the one who is driving the car that hits her. So he shows up to the funeral and is promptly ejected, and then 13 years later, they find themselves in the writer's room for the TV adaptation of our heroine's YA novels, and our hero is the screenwriter who's like the number two in the writer's room.
Very good.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, great setup. Yeah.
So we're focused on the romance genre this year and trying to learn as much as we can.
We're looking at all these different tropes that are in romance and trying to figure out where novels fit in, and they should never be together or never get together. And then there's the enemies to lovers trope. So when you were writing it or after you finished it, can you identify what kind of trope it is in? Is it they should never be together?
Yeah, I do this kind of exercise once a year where I write down my id level tropes. So like the things on a lizard brain level, I could not explain to you why I'm so drawn to them, but I just am. And anytime it's like in a piece of fiction, I'm like, oh yes, give me more. And so I write down all my id level tropes on the glass dry erase board, and I look at them, and it's kind of like when you go to the kitchen and you open your spice cabinet and you're like, what are my spices that I'm working with? My id level tropes are kind of those spices. And so I remember I had We Mustn't, which is kind of that energy that you're describing. Like there is something about like a we mustn't that I'm really drawn to. I guess other people would call that star-crossed lovers, but I think that we mustn't is more evocative because it's more than just star-crossed. It's like, we can't even touch. It would be bad if we did that. So we mustn't. And then in terms of the other tropes that are in it, there's definitely a dash of enemies to lovers, but I think I diluted that quite a bit because I don't think they're actually true enemies in here, but I think there is this feeling that maybe they should be. And so that's definitely a flavor, maybe like a note that comes through. I'm trying to remember what the other ones are. Like definitely a little bit of hurt comfort, I think, which is, I think, more of a trope that originates in fan fiction, which is where my creative origin story kind of begins. I was a fan fiction writer. I read a lot of Harry Potter fan fiction back in the day. And so, yeah, there's definitely a little bit of that hurt, comfort, angst. And then there's just maybe the meta layer of writers falling in love, which is something I'm always drawn to, which I think all writers are because we're all a little bit self-obsessed. And it's like, if I'm going to do the heavy lifting of bringing this story into the world, then I should be the protagonist.
That's awesome. Yeah. What was the spark for this story? Is it something that that's been percolating for a long time for you, or did it come suddenly?
Possibly. I would say, in the short term, it was that everything else I was working on at the time, it was October 2021 when I decided to write this. I was working on a lot of adaptations and I meant to write an original feature for myself to direct, but it was October. So I kept seeing all these things about NaNoWriMo being right around the corner. And I had always kind of been aware of it, but I had never participated. And I had always known, like, eventually I would like to write a novel in my lifetime. And then I don't know, maybe it was the fact that we were like 1 year away from the pandemic that I was just like, well, tomorrow is not promised. Maybe I should write that novel now. Because I was busy, I didn't want to do anything that had like too much research involved. So I was like, well, I'm working on adaptation all the time. Let's do something about adaptation. So I knew it was going to be about a screenwriter and a novelist. I knew that they were going to know each other in high school, but the way that they were linked didn't come until about 36 hours before I started drafting. It was a very late in the game thing. I feel like the manuscript I ended up with was not necessarily the book I set out to write, but looking back, it makes a lot of sense to me that this is the book I ended up writing because it was just like I set up a lot of chess pieces and I couldn't have told you at the time like why I was drawn to those things. But looking back, I'm just like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Like I was kind of spending a lot of time, you know, immersed in Emily Henry's words and thinking a lot about how the things that I was drawn to in her world, what shared wounds do I have with Emily Henry a little bit, where why are we both drawn to these certain themes? Why do I see so much of myself in these things? And so I was kind of drawn to the idea of exploring what kind of shared wound a screenwriter and a novelist could have.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because one of the things that really surprised me about the novel, I mean, you just talked about how it starts with a suicide, and then there's a lot of undigested grief for both the main characters, Helen and Grant. And I wasn't really expecting that when I opened up a romance love story.
With my very pink cover, yeah.
Why did you want to tackle those pretty heavy subjects in this romance?
I've known a lot of people in my life who have struggled with some pretty like serious mental health issues. I too have struggled. And I kind of wanted to explore the perspective of the people that are left behind, what it is to love somebody like that and know you can't help them or it's too late and the worst case scenario has already happened. Or in Grant's case, somebody who's deeply affected by it, but didn't even potentially know the person. That was kind of thematically what I was interested in exploring here.
Yeah, and I'm just early on in the novel. I haven't finished it yet, but I appreciate the way you show that they've done a lot of work and therapy and techniques to help them with what they're going through. And I don't want to give any spoilers about anything, but I appreciate that a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I also think that it's interesting thinking again about enemies to lovers or something, even the word enemies. These are two people who were on opposite sides of what this situation were. But for any of us who have experienced loss, we know that people who are going through it, even if there's different reasons that they're feeling the loss, they have that shared bond of the shared loss. You know, I didn't say that very well, but that's what's happening here. So I really appreciated that about the novel.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to show the ugly side of what grief and pain like that can be, because I know there have been times where I have been on Instagram scrolling through various mental health things and felt like, oh, there's a correct way to grieve and there's an incorrect way. But that doesn't necessarily help all the weird, petty thoughts, right? And so I guess I wanted to use the book as a way to explore all of those things that are like, these are things that maybe aren't nice. These aren't very Instagram infographic friendly thoughts, but I think they're worth discussing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We wanted to also ask you a little bit about your screenwriting experience, and you're also a director. But what is it like to be in the writing room?
Yeah.
There was a quote we wanted to read, right? Let's see.
Oh, it's so nice to see the book with like tabs in it. I haven't really seen that very much.
Yeah. And you could tell Emily was in the bathtub reading it.
Just something I've been having a little issue with lately is getting my books wet, but that just means I'm enjoying
them. I love seeing this book used in the world. It's so great. Doesn't get old.
So there's this one scene, and it's early on in the book, and we couldn't help think about your professional career, as you know, I said, as a screenwriter and somebody who's a filmmaker. And I'm going to read this paragraph. It's from the head writer, the lead writer of the screenplay in the novel, talking with Helen, the author of the novels.
Right. We should preface it by saying that Helen wrote a very, very popular YA series, and now she's in the writing room where they're adapting
the
books.
Yeah, so she's in LA. And so Helen is saying she won't be precious about things. She's just going to be in the room, and she understands that things are going to happen, right, in the room to her story. The head writer then says, "Be precious and annoying if it's important to you. That's your role in the room. Protect the book when we've gone too far off the rails. It's no good to us if we put in all this work and your readers hate everything we've done." And, you know, that to me was kind of a revelation, because I think I've heard more of the stereotypes of popular books that then get turned into screenplays that the fans hate, right? To hear a screenwriter talk to the writer about, you know, protecting this story and protecting the fans, I thought that was really amazing. So we were wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experience as a writer in the rooms for filmmaking.
So I kind of got into this whole thing because of how much of a reader I was. I loved the Harry Potter books when I was growing up, and I remember watching the announcements of all those movies getting made, just like gnawing at my fingernails, like, oh my God, if they fuck this up, they're going to fuck up my childhood. And so I eventually kind of dreamed and schemed my way to a point where I had a little bit more ownership over my favorite books. But then there is that tension where I'm so aware of how many people love these books and how I don't want to let them down. But at the same time, as a screenwriter, I do believe that the purpose of adaptation is to bring new audiences to the original source material. It's not just to please 100% of the readership, which you're never going to do anyway. Because of that, my loyalty has to be to the screen adaptation. I have to protect that above what I think is going to please the book people. That being said, if I was in a situation where I was in a writer's room and I had hired the novelist, then it would be completely pointless to hire them if it wasn't to use what they were there for, which is somebody who understands the book more than anybody else. Like, whenever I run into an issue, sometimes I'll text Emily and I'll ask her a question about these characters. And she understands these characters on a deep, fundamental level. And that makes sense because they originated from her. And so it would be a waste of a resource if you didn't look at the author in that way, as a resource and a tool to make the adaptation better. But we shouldn't both be doing that, because then it would be redundant. Is kind of how I look at that. In terms of my own experiences in writers' rooms, it's actually kind of different because I was very young when I was handed my first TV show. So I had done this short film on my YouTube channel that you previously alluded to. It was called Eulene is Working. I am no longer active on my YouTube channel. However, I had a short film called I Ship It about a wizard rock battle of the bands and a girl who's trying to get back her ex-boyfriend through them. And we sold that short film to the CW Seed, which was the CW's digital platform. I did that as a web series. It won a Streamy Award. They came back to me and they asked, do you want to do this as a TV show? And I said, yes. I was, I think, 27 years old at the time, and I was handed my first TV show. I hired a very strong number two. Her name is Ann Lewis Hamilton, and she had worked on all of these huge shows that I loved, like 30-something and One Tree Hill and Grey's Anatomy, and I just respected her so much. And it was this kind of thing where I felt deep imposter syndrome when I was running my own writer's room, and I don't feel that I was fully in control of my instrument at that point in time. Like, I look back on the TV show that we made, which premiered to the second lowest ratings that the CW has ever had, and you can now watch that only in Canada on the CBC Gem app. You will find I Ship It, but the web series is listed as season one, and then the TV show, which is a totally different story but featuring the same actors, is listed as season two, but they've divided each episode into two episodes. It sounds insane when I talk about it, but I feel like I have to so the world can know. And I'm not just gaslighting myself. So it was this kind of thing where I look back on that and I'm like, I think the heart of the story I wanted to tell is in there, but I don't think I had as many dials. I had buttons, not dials, as a storyteller at that point in time. And the only way I could really get better was by going through that experience. And so I think I gave a little bit of that to Helen, where her first TV show experience is her show, which is kind of insane. And I feel so lucky that I had that opportunity. But also, you know, there's a lot of things I would do differently now, having gone through it already.
I like that metaphor, buttons as opposed to dials. You're such a writer, Eulene. It's really nice.
Yes.
One of the things I loved about the novel was getting kind of a backstage pass to what it is like to be in a writer's room, which I have to admit, I've never thought that much about. I always thought a bunch of people sit in a room and they talk about what it's going to be, but it never occurred to me, like, then they have to go and actually write what they're talking about, and that different writers in the room take care of different episodes or different plot points or whatever it is that they're going to do. And this is such a nitpicky question, but how do different writers go out and write, but then somehow it all feels like it's a story that's told smoothly and seamlessly? You know, it's different than a novel that is written by one person.
Yeah. In television, it kind of falls to the vision of the showrunner. So the person that's in charge of the overall thing being stylistically cohesive throughout will break the story for the season inside the writer's room, and then we'll break the individual episodes, and then we'll assign the episodes to different writers, and then they'll bring in their scripts. And then the way that we did it in our writer's room was they turned in their first draft, I gave them notes, they did a revision, and then I would do a pass just to make sure that the dialogue across everything was uniform. So that's kind of how you try to protect the vision.
That's really cool. So from that creative collaboration that you experience in the writer's room to then writing your own novel, was it almost a relief to just be there with yourself and your laptop or whatever writing tools you use, or did you miss that creative collaboration?
I primarily work as a features screenwriter now, so that is very isolated, like novel writing, I guess. I was honestly so desperate to do something like writing the novel, in that I wanted to know what story I would tell if I didn't have to convince other people to let me tell it first. Because with the screenplays, I just knew if I wrote something, then I would have to go send it off to my agents, and then they would have their notes, and then they would be like, okay, we can try and find a, attach a producer. We'll send it out to all these different producers, and then we would have to see who liked it. And then we would send it out to cast and see who could kind of get on board with the vision and felt like I was at the right point in my career and they were at the right point in their career to do that kind of matchmaking. And then we'd have to go out to financiers who would then assess the entire package and decide, like, how much money are you worth? Which is kind of unsettling, you know, to think about. Lots of therapy necessary in this profession, honestly. So I thought about all that and I got so mentally exhausted because I was already pre-negotiating with myself, like, oh, should I have like cheaper set pieces? Should I do this and that? And I was like, well, what would happen if I just wrote something that there is no budget in your imagination, right? So I can write whatever and you're limited only by what you can picture. And I really liked the idea of that because I've had so many projects kind of languish in what we call development hell. Mm. I've sold so many things and developed so many things that I love. And you have to fall in love with every project. You have to tell yourself, no, this one's going to make it. This one's going to go all the way through to the end. And it's going to be good too, because it takes so much effort just to get a movie made, let alone a good one. So it's this self-delusion that you have to buy into that, like, against all odds, this is the one that's going to work. It's kind of like falling in love. You have to kind of tell yourself, like, I know it hadn't worked out like last time or the time before, but this one's it. And I don't know, maybe I had a couple too many heartbreaks, one after another. So I was like, I'm going to write a book. I need a break. I need to take a step back. And it felt really, really good. I was in kind of a fugue state, honestly, through all of November that year, where I was waking up at 5 a.m., writing until 10 a.m. I would switch over to People We Meet on Vacation, draft until about 4 or 5 p.m. And then I'd switch back to the novel from about 5 to like midnight, if I could keep going that long, and just repeat it daily, except on the weekends when I would focus entirely on the novel. It was the most intense thing I've ever done. I have not been able to replicate that process for book two at all, but it was great. It was magical. I'm so glad I got to live through it.
Oh. Wow. And I'm happy to hear there's a book two in the works.
Yes. Same characters or different characters?
Different. Okay. All of that. Yeah. Standalone romance. That's what I'm interested in.
Oh, very cool. Right on. So from the literary shorts, the films on your YouTube channel, it seems like you're a fan of 19th century literature. Because you have the Edgar Allan Poe vlog, which is hysterical. Yes. So can you talk a little bit about, was 19th century a big inspiration for you?
I think my starter pack in romance, if we go there, was probably Jane Austen novels, Harry Potter fan fiction, and then any BBC period dramas that I could get my hands on, like North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell. There's that adaptation with Richard Armitage where he's like standing in the snow watching her drive off and he's like, look back at me. And I just remember like, oh my God, tearing my heart out. this is what I want forever. So I would say that's the through line of everything that I am interested in. I think that people who come from fan fiction, there's almost like a vernacular that develops where there are certain things and tropes that you're really drawn to and dynamics you find compelling. And I can definitely see the thread of that in my work. I would say at this point in time, I wrote this more for the Bronte girls than the Austen girls. I see Jane Austen as she's deeply consistent and her work is so beautiful and wonderful. But it's not as wild as the Brontes on the Moors, right? I would say that the Brontes, they were maybe not as precise craft-wise as Austen, but they sure were fun.
Well, one of the big differences between Austen and the Brontes and Eulene is hot sex. Your book is filled with great hot sex scenes. What was it like to write those?
Oh, it was really freeing. I loved doing it. I wasn't sure I was going to do it, to be honest. There's a passage early on where Helen says something about how her books are people poring over 17th century texts and pining over each other with like 19th century romance novel vibes. And it's because that she doesn't want her parents to know she's had sex, essentially. And I think I come from a similarly repressed background, I would say. I grew up in Kansas, so there was definitely 5 years of repression through being in the buckle of the Bible Belt, as we called it back there. And then when I moved to New Jersey, my parents enrolled me in like a year of Catholic school. That'll do something to you. And then we just had the standard issue, parents from China in a different time vibe. And then I also had a much younger sister. So my sister, Olivia, is 14 years younger than me. And I think that created this effect where other children of immigrants, their parents probably chilled out a little bit more when they went to college. But because I had this really big age gap, I think my parents kind of anchored their bias towards the younger sibling in terms of what felt appropriate. And so you talk about my YouTube channel. I think if you look at any of the work I was putting out then in the 2010s, there's this very kind of twee, sexless vibe. I want to seem like the internet's clean older sister. And that's because I knew everything that I was saying was going to be projected back to my sister, who at that point in time was maybe 10 years old. And so I wanted everything to be family friendly. But also, I was so horny. I was like in my 20s. I come from fandom, and I think fandom kind of divides itself along certain lines. I come from the horny side of fandom. Like, I think that also goes back to the Austin Bronte divide. I think that there is sex in Bronte. It's just a little bit more unspoken. So I think there was something in that thread that there was a tension there. And so when it came time to write this novel, I was challenging myself, you know, Eileen, you got married this year. I had gotten married in August that year. Your parents probably know you've had sex by now.
At least once, maybe.
At least once, probably. And my sister was going to become I think, junior or senior in high school. So I was just like, all right, times are changing. And do you want to live your entire life in fear of what your parents will think, I guess? And so I kind of edged my way into writing my first sex scene. Like, I opened with that, where it was kind of a promise I was delivering to myself in that passage where Helen's like, I can't write about sex or anything salacious. And it was like, okay, for a character like that, then the journey is that we're going to see something, right? I write in Scrivener, and Scrivener has this helpful right-hand panel where you can jot down notes, and I would write the beats that I was writing towards. And I remember there was one beat I really wanted to get in there, which was Grant masturbates over Helen's scrunchie. And I originally had that in they go on this writing retreat in, like, there's a cabin in the woods. I originally had it in that section, but I couldn't make myself do it. Like, I was like, no, it's too soon. It's too, like, I don't even know if I can write a masturbation scene. So it kept getting punted, but it was like at the bottom of every chapter I was writing, is this the chapter where he's going to do it? So when he finally does it, spoiler alert, Grant masturbates over Helen's scrunchie eventually in this book. I was so proud of myself. I like cheered. I was like, oh my gosh. And honestly, I don't even think that scene is necessarily the spiciest scene in the book. But for me, it was a turning point because it was the first time I had written something on that level of horny. And I guess once I had opened that floodgate, I was writing other scenes too.
Well, you know, I saw a scrunchie on the floor in the YMCA locker room the other day, and I have to say, you can never look at a scrunchie again the same way after you've read this novel. So
I love that.
And when I was talking about this on a past episode of the podcast, I read the acknowledgement section where you wrote to your parents and said, you know, if you haven't read this book yet, please skip, and you name off all the chapters with sex scenes. I laughed so hard when I read that. So sweet. But we're glad you did it.
Yeah, I feel like it's a weird thing to hand a book like this to your parents, because I'm like, I feel like the dutiful child thing that I could have done was dedicated to them, but it felt weird. Mm-hmm. It feels weird to dedicate a book with this much smut to a family member, you know?
Yes. It's just great. Oh, well, I mean, it's interesting because we do quarterly read-alongs with our listeners, and the first book we read was Indigo by Beverly Jenkins, and then we did a Zoom conversation about it. And it was interesting to me to talk to people and find out what is their thing about reading and reading sex scenes, and what do they like, what don't they like. And I think that's one of the things we're all trying to discover in this year of reading romance.
Yeah, I
think it's so important to read romance and read sex scenes, because I think especially my generation of millennials, we kind of grew up with this like purity culture going on in the air that I don't know that Gen Z has inherited so much. Like, I think correctly, the culture has become a lot more liberal in terms of especially women owning their sexuality. But the damage got in there early for millennials. So really, I think I'm writing for us. And it's nice to be able to explore all those things and kind of figure out your id a little bit. Like, I think that's such an important thing to get in touch with.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this has been such a great conversation. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us just before the launch of your first novel. I know your life's, sounds like it's already busy. It's probably going to get very busy. I saw that you have events in the United States and in Canada.
I sure do. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. We will put links in the show notes so people can follow your book tour and hopefully come and meet you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and really best of luck with this launch.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The Book Cougars with Chris Wallach and Emily Fine. We'll be back again with another episode in 2 weeks. Until then, come chat with us on social media, Goodreads, or email us at bookcougars@gmail.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast, please tell others about us, leave a review wherever you listen, and consider becoming a patron. Even $1 a month is a big help. Learn more about that on our website, bookcougars.com, where you'll find the show notes for this and all of our past episodes.
Thanks, everybody.
This episode was edited by Pat Keough Sound Design.